now.
And welcome to the SBK Crypto Podcast. 15 minutes of crypto fame.
My name is Charles Story. I'll be your host the next 15 minutes. We're coming live from the city of London, Shoreditch. So let's get down to business. In fact, this show is not going to be 15 minutes long. This is a really exciting podcast that was done today live from the SVK Crypto HQ here in East London. The podcast was originally supposed to be myself and Rob Finch talking about what's new with Cypherglass and what's going on with EOS. But we had an exceptional meeting with Jared Madfiz. Jared came into our office an hour before Rob Finch's arrival and blew us away, and we decided to have a joint podcast, including Jared. The podcast, we discussed everything. There was no format. There was just the three of us talking about blockchain, the gig economy, AI, politics. We were discussing funding mechanisms in the cryptocurrency and blockchain space, to whether the technological advancement we've been making in the last 10 years is for the better of humanity as a whole. We discuss everything. This is one of the most exciting podcasts that I've had the opportunity to record and present, and I hope you find it the same way. So with that in mind, let's get into the interview and let's get down to business. My name is Charles Story. I'll be your host for the next 15 minutes. We're coming live from the city of London, Shoreditch. So let's get down to business. With me, well, originally it was supposed to be myself and Rob Finch, but from an exceptional meeting we had with Jared Madfiz.
No, I'm the last one. Like, there'll be no other Madfizes.
No, not yet.
Kids. Yeah, well, no, if I have kids, then there will be. But besides me, like, we're all dead.
You're the last one.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why the FBI is
coming
for you.
So after an exceptional meeting, we wanted to really get both of them in here, roll the punches, open this up, discuss all things crypto, and see where it goes.
Yeah.
So why don't we get a quick intro. Rob, would be so kind to intro yourself for those who don't know who you are, what you do, everything like that. Let's go.
Yeah, so I am a part of an amazing team over at Cypherglass, which is an EOS block producer. Essentially, we're one of many people around the world that keep the network online. And in addition to that, we invest and also build our own EOS projects, dApps, things of that nature.
Yeah, and I'm Jared Madfiz. These days I've been focused on pricing risk for custody insurance, but in the past I've done a bunch of work around game theory and generally like mechanism design, and still work with a few groups doing that to this day.
So we'd like to hear, so what's exciting you most in the space in the minute? Because Rob, you're solely focused on EOS, you're a block producer, you're doing lots of different things in that realm, not only with the community side of things, but also building up the network itself. Jared, you're doing lots of different things, not only consultancy basis, but you're also looking at different sectors, and I know gaming and gambling is one of those. So why don't we talk about that first? What is exciting you both most about gaming at this current point in time, and why?
Yeah, I think I'm excited about gaming on EOS, particularly when it relates to NFTs and SFTs, so non-fungible tokens, semi-fungible tokens, essentially unique digital objects that a player can own. And what got me super excited about gaming, you know, obviously we've seen all these casinos launch on EOS. That was exciting for a little bit, but what has me really hyped today is companies like Mythical Games, who are building AAA titles. These are guys Blankos is amazing.
So I had
a chance to play it at South by Southwest, such a cool game. But these are guys who built World of Warcraft, they built Call of Duty, they built all of these AAA titles, and now have decided to make their own game studio on EOS. So that I'm just super hyped about today.
So you mentioned semi-fungible tokens. I have no idea what that is.
Okay.
Yeah. Could you expand on that a little bit?
It's very similar to an NFT. So if I had a one-of-one, like Excalibur sword, like this is the only one that exists, an NFT because only one exists.
Sure.
But if there were 1,000 of those swords that each had a unique serial number, 1 to 1,000, that's an SFT, a semi-fungible token.
Okay, interesting.
A fully fungible token, as an example, in the gaming context, could be like a mana potion. Like,
Yeah.
There's plenty of these out in the world. You know, you can trade them one-to-one with other people.
Yeah. No, I've never heard that. The distinction, I always thought of them all as NFTs, but no, that's actually a very relevant subset.
Yeah, so. And this is a big part of the DGood standard at dgoods.org. It's an open source free standard on EOS for all of these digital goods.
So. dgoods.org.
dgoods.org.
Okay, cool. I'll make sure to check that out.
Awesome.
And then in terms of things that are exciting me, kind of the ways that we can use non-fungible tokens or semi-fungible tokens as themselves as distribution mechanisms within games. I think that we're going to see the way gamers go about promoting and distributing their games radically change as some of these protocols continue to grow. So that's really exciting. And then just anything related to financial products, in terms of like multi-party settlement, all that. I love to see.
So. Awesome. How do you think people are going to distribute their games?
Yeah, so I think that right now you look at companies like Voodoo Games and Tencent that are obviously, Tencent's on another level, but in terms of mobile games, Voodoo is incredible. For anyone who doesn't know what Voodoo Games is, they make those random games that you'll see ads on your iPhone for, and you're like, oh, this seems simple, like maybe I'll download it. But once you're playing one of them, you're hooked in. Hmm. And they monitor how much you play. And like when you're playing a lot, they'll show you ads from other people. But when your playtime diminishes, they'll start showing you ads to a different one of their games.
Oh, wow.
So basically, like all these different third-party developer studios partner with them, develop games for them. And then they kind of push you between games. And then they'll also like push you ads via Instagram and Facebook to really like try and get you to play the next game to keep the cycle going. And they have like tons of the top 10 games that keep getting downloaded, and their marketing and distribution mechanisms are so tied in that, you know, I think their last round they raised at like a $500 million valuation.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. No, that's they're wild. Yeah, they're a behemoth, a silent behemoth in mobile games. Other ones that are really big, Catch App is another one that does something similar, not quite to the same degree. But,
with a K, right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. Catch App, not Catch Up.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of both.
Yeah, yeah. So I look at companies like these, and I think, why do those indie developers themselves actually need this distribution system? If there was a protocol of interoperability, if there was some incentive mechanism where they could actually be rewarded for including other people's items, giving those items functionality in their games, whether that's representing them as is or having, you know, a gun unlock a secret level or a secret character or something completely different, and then kind of having circular operability where you're constantly curious, what does my NFT in this game give me in another game? If you have a protocol for all of those things, I think it could get very interesting with indie developers kind of promoting each other's games. And then if you own the exchange as well, you could theoretically have those royalties be paid back through the group that originated that item, so that you want other groups to use your items as items in their games. So then you're encouraged to push like to your users, hey, this item that you have here actually unlocks something in this game, go use it, and then market spikes on demand sparks on a secondary market, and then you're making money that way. So I think that, I don't know if you've heard Sam Englebart talk. Actually, I know you have.
Yeah,
we were at the same talk, EOS New York.
Definitely.
So he loves talking about the metaverse.
Yeah.
And the way I see it, the metaverse is either going to be like explicit in that there's this world and similar to Second Life. Is that what they're calling it? No, what's
High
the
Fidelity.
Oh, High Fidelity. Yeah. High Fidelity.
High Fidelity is sort of the next generation.
The next gen. Yeah, so in something like High Fidelity, and everyone's building things specifically in and on High Fidelity. But I think there will also be more of a fragmented metaverse where through interoperability, a bunch of things are kind of loosely linked. And I think that could also be very interesting. And I'm not sure how that will form, but I think something like it will.
That's interesting. I mean, with the build out that we're currently seeing in the blockchain space, or blockchain gaming space, what people are really struggling with is getting consumer grade like games, right? So like they have a small community of gamers using it in the blockchain space. Like no one's really been able to branch out yet to do that. I mean, there's projects like Azarus and a few other guys who are looking to try and build into traditional games. What do you see will hold, or what do you think will help the bridge between the two? Because
I mean, they're kind of separated. As you said, Blankos is huge, right? Like Mythical Games is as about legit of a unit you could possibly build. If Blankos struggles to get and capture non-crypto users, I will be a little bit worried, to be honest. But games are a hit-driven business, and if that one fails, I'm sure they'll make another one. I don't think it's going to, because it's actually pretty fun.
Well, I can tell you, based on the reaction of people at the South by Southwest event that I was at, where they sort of unveiled the first round of gameplay, the first game type in Blankos, there were people that had no idea this was going to be on a blockchain, collecting and trading the cards while they were there. So I think they might have that part covered.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've got to wait and see what happens when the game launches later this year, but I have a good feeling about it.
I think that gambling, right, was the first industry to really be disrupted by blockchain, in particular EOS. And I think that's really overlooked in many ways, shape, and form. Like, people really focus on gaming now, and I understand it's more exciting in many ways. But gambling itself has a real use case, and blockchain within that. Why do you think people are overlooking that and trying to avoid that and brush it away and trying to focus on gaming? Like, why is that? Why is there so much negativity towards gambling itself on EOS?
I think people like to take their own moral framework, which is fine. It's great. We can all have these different, you know, sets of morals, but they like to take that and apply it to any system that they're a part of. So when they see something like gambling, if that goes against their own moral code, you know, maybe they're not a gambler, they're very quick to sort of dismiss it and push it away. But what people don't realize is that these gambling sites, like you said, really do serve a real utility.
Yeah.
There are so many cases, and maybe you can speak to this as well, that there are centralized websites that on the back end will frequently switch the results to screw over their users.
Yeah, so the reason I'm actually in London at the moment is that I'm here doing a consulting gig for an online casino to actually develop and build out a way for them to interface with digital assets. So, you know, you look at the success of EOS Bet, and I can tell you firsthand that that has influenced many of the incumbents that now want to start, you know, paying back portions of the revenue to their users based on how much they're gambling.
Right.
So what I'm actually here designing is a kind of security token that people can earn while they gamble. And with a lot of these online casinos, especially regulated ones, like the one that I'm here working with that I can't say who, you already have to go through KYC AML to even gamble in the first place. So that's already all done. So you can actually deposit the security tokens directly in people's accounts. You know, have a very simple wallet interface where people can move it off if they want, but then pay those dividends directly into their accounts. So in many ways, I think a lot of these groups will continue to shift over the regular gamblers into part owners. And I think the influence of EOS and EOS Bet is not to be understated in this trend.
Definitely. And I think that's probably a trend that we'll see beyond just gaming and gambling. I think virtually any business, even Starbucks. I mean, you can imagine they have those gold points that you get on a card and then you get free Starbucks. Imagine if you could get a percent of Starbucks revenue back on your Starbucks card just for actually going and being a patron of the business. Like the business models I think that this whole industry makes possible are just insane, and we've only scratched the surface.
Of course, and I think it becomes especially important in revenues or in industries that are highly commoditized, right? Like between Uber and Lyft, which one would you rather drive for? The one that pays you a set amount or the one that like allows you to continue earning a percentage of overall revenue. So I think in these kind of businesses, especially any two-sided marketplace, that sort of, you know, kickback will be increasingly important. In the same way that some block producers that promised to pay a little bit back.
Yeah.
Where the value of building things in a community is not always completely apparent.
Right. And as a note, that has screwed over many other DPoS systems like Lisk with the cartel.
Yeah, it's been horrible.
So if you're out there on EOS, don't expect to get a paycheck from any of the BPs.
No, nor should you. I think the main people have a false equivalency between the two, right? Like it's very different as like a driver on Uber where you're just driving, and the act of driving creates value for the market, for the overall community. But as a block producer, yes, confirming blocks creates value in and of itself, but there's so much that still has to be built out in terms of infrastructure that it almost acts as like community funding. And that I personally think that's a much better use of funds.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And we've seen that on EOS already with block producers partnering together or just doing stuff on their own, investing tons and tons of money into different infrastructure layer you know, developments or even dApps themselves. So it's been really cool to see that system actually finally work. I was a part of Lisk and Rise, which is now, Rise is just dead now. It went to zero and got delisted everywhere. But both of those systems had a horrible problem with a cartel that came in and said, hey, we'll give you 50% of our block awards. And then it was 60 and 70 and 80 and 90 to the point where they couldn't even support the network anymore. So it's really a flawed system, and I'm hoping that doesn't happen on EOS as well.
I think it's really interesting with EOS because you've seen the top 21 block producers constantly changing. I know last night you were in the top 21, and now
you're... very briefly. I think we made an extra 40 EOS because of it, so shout out to everybody for the votes. Then there was a I don't know if it's a bug or an intended feature, but if you stake any amount of CPU or net to someone else's account, you can reduce their voting decay to zero. So basically with EOS, if I vote 100 tokens, I lose two of those tokens in voting power every week. It's like 1% a week. And somebody realized, oh, you can stake a small amount and undo that voting decay and basically bring a bunch of votes up. So shortly after we got in the top 21 from just a new big voter, that voting decay thing got leaked. And then we got bumped back down to 22. So it's okay. It's okay. We'll get back to 21. We're 11 million votes higher now than when I got to London. So that's all good
things. So voting decay, is that a feature or a bug?
That's a feature.
No, the bug that stops voting decay.
Oh, I think it could be looked at as a bug, because the whole purpose of Voting Decay is to encourage people to, you know, reevaluate their votes and vote again. And I think it's okay if you're staking to your own account.
Yeah.
But if another random account is staking me 0.0001 net,
and that undoes it,
and that undoes my Voting Decay, I think that might be a bug. So it'll be interesting to see what Block One says now that this is all out there.
Yeah. So I think this is personally very interesting to me because it's, you know, how do we form consensus over which changes need to be made to the core protocol?
Right.
So, you know, the bug was identified. It's causing some things that are unintended consequences that are against the initial design. Obviously, Block One needs to come out with some kind of statement, but at the same time, it's supposed to be an open ecosystem where the block producers and the Definitely. People themselves. So what has been done since then in terms of conversation between Cypherglass and other block producers in terms of like, hey, should we fix this, guys? What do you think?
I think this all just happened this morning I woke up to the tweet saying, hey, by the way, if you stake 0.01 to anybody, you can do it. So this all just started, but there definitely is a conversation ongoing in the EOS mainnet BP's channel to sort of figure out what to do here. I think more than likely, because the intent of Vote Decay is to keep people engaged, that this will be undone.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that anyone is upset that there are more people voting now or more tokens being voted now, because it does ultimately make the network more secure.
I think what's interesting about that is that different block producers have different strengths, right? And there's different block producers out there that I know have really doubled down on the ability to develop cool stuff. So that would probably go to them rather than the block producers who are looking to promote community and brand, right? Like, everyone has different strengths and everyone has different weaknesses, and I guess it's up to them to really take full control of that, and that's something that they want to do because they want to be the guys who solve the issue or solve the bug. So I think that's really interesting about different block producers and the way they work together as well, especially on EOS.
Yeah, definitely. And I noticed looking back in, you know, my transaction history on some of my accounts that people had actually staked me 0.001 net a few weeks ago. So this is something that's been going on for a while. Somebody knew about it and has been using it to their advantage. Probably somebody I was voting for from that account. So this has definitely been out there, and somebody chose not to share it with the community, which I think is an interesting play. But now it's out there, everybody knows, and Voting Decay went from 400 million to like 170 million. So
wow.
Pretty huge. It's good news for the network.
So let's talk about the gig economy.
Yeah.
Switch up here. Because the gig economy is something that fascinates me, and especially when you guys are talking about Uber. You mentioned it, Jared. What's your view on the gig economy, and what do you think blockchain's role will play within that?
Yeah, so I think you're seeing some really, really cool projects. If you look at a project called Deco Network, DECO.network, out of SF, they're building a lot of these open source tools. Right now, I will say they're product is for Ethereum, but they're actually building a version of it for EOS as well, so don't worry, I'm not shilling the anime. If you look at a group like this, they're kind of building out a lot of the escrow contracts and things to allow groups to be able to kind of put up a job, show you know, it being filled on a day-to-day basis, and then transfer funds in real time. So I think that blockchain is really, really useful for building out some of that financial infrastructure that allows groups to kind of transact without needing to trust each other. And I think the gig economy will only continue to diversify as more of these kind of open source projects that allow people to put up funds and then have them be delivered instantaneously continue to get better and better.
Yeah, and I think that the gig economy right now is obviously a huge part of our economy with Uber and Lyft and Postmates and all these different things. But I think it will continue to be an even bigger part of the world economy as more and more jobs get automated.
Yeah.
Like the people that are driving for Uber now are the people that were cashiers that got replaced by a screen now where you just order. And as truck driving gets automated and all these other industries get automated, there are going to be millions and millions of people that need some other source of income. So I think we'll see a lot of people, maybe you're in VR and high fidelity doing a gig in there, and then you hop out for a couple hours and drive for Uber, and then you do something else at night. So it's going to be interesting.
It comes
to
back
see
to the metaverse, right?
Yeah.
I think we're going to see a huge amount of people working gigs in the metaverse.
Yeah.
Just because, like, I mean, that was Brock Pierce's first big company. It was he would pay people to farm for
gold,
currency.
Yeah,
gold in World of Warcraft.
IGE.
IGE. So I think we're going to see a lot of similar things to that, especially, you know, what, 3 million truckers are going to be replaced?
Five, I think. Is
5 million?
Oh,
my God.
The piece I watched a couple days ago.
Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what else are, like, there's only so many jobs. Like,
oh, 100%.
5 million unemployed people tomorrow, what are we doing with them?
Oh, yeah. One, people don't realize that this is happening now. Like, 5 years ago, I remember talking to my dad, and shout out to my dad if you're listening, saying, oh, it's going to be 50 years till self-driving cars come. Now I own a self-driving car. So it's like, this stuff is here today. The trucks are being automated today.
Yeah.
There are trucks doing routes from Las Vegas to California on a daily basis. So
let me ask a question. do you think the advance of technology is for the better of humanity? Like, in some ways, you're talking about people's jobs being replaced by robots, right?
Yeah.
And then maybe you find the new jobs maybe within the metaverse, right? But that's maybe not guaranteed. Like, there's a lot of maybes out there. Do you think that's for the better of everyone?
I think there are, we're going into like Elon Musk territory here now. I think there are two potential scenarios. One where all of this automation and everything is incredibly beneficial to basically everyone, and everybody benefits, everybody has a higher quality of life, maybe most people don't have to work. But I think the other scenario is there are billions of people that lose their job and can't afford to buy food, can't afford to do anything, and it's a horrible situation for people who don't have the resources, i.e. money, to actually survive in that new economy.
Yeah, and I agree. I think that we're going to need some kind of UBI system. And I think crypto is actually going to be a really interesting way to implement that.
Yeah.
One of the scariest things that I heard when I was in China, because I spent a few months in between Shenzhen and Beijing, was someone was telling me that the government was having talks. I don't know if this is true, right? What do people know about the government in China? Where they were basically saying, you know, most of our currency is digital already. You know, what if we start tracking it with some kind of distributed ledger technology? People, you know, they have the Xiaomei score, the social credit scores.
Yeah,
and what if
that's
scary. What if we start fully automating things and then we tailor the universal basic income to your citizen score? Where the better citizen you are, the more money you get. And then anytime there's serious civil unrest, all you have to do is take 51% of that distressed group and bump the amount of money that they're getting to turn them against the other side. So I think that,
oh my god,
this is obviously a terrifying situation, but the inverse of it is, you know, maybe you have some kind of non-sovereign identity and non-sovereign like credit score, and I love talking about like velocity of money, where, you know, if you give $100 to Bill Gates, it's in his bank account. If you give $100 to someone in debt, it gets spent immediately. Distributing some kind of universal basic income is a highly effective way to increase the overall volumes of the economy if the money's going to the right people. So if it's going to people that have the velocity where they're going to turn it over within a month, that will obviously spur spending and growth, and all that's great. So I think that blockchain, specifically if we can get a better handle on non-sovereign identity and non-sovereign credit, provides a really easy solution for people tailoring payments payouts to the people that need it the most, that will spend it the most, and overall that will be incredible for global production.
Yeah, I used to be heavily against UBI even as recently as last year, and as I've done more research into AI and gone way too deep down some rabbit holes where you can get like in a dark place if you start looking at AI too much, which I think is where Elon Musk goes a lot.
Someone made a deep fake of me once and I was not happy.
Really?
One of my friends did it.
Now you're in the database. It knows you. It's
I was not happy.
Oh god. Deep fake for those listening is when you can basically take a bunch of images of somebody and videos and make a new video that's just from scratch. The person didn't actually say those things.
You can graph someone's face on someone else.
Yeah.
And then it looks like they're doing things that they don't do.
I've seen that with like Donald Trump, right? Where have got him saying stuff that Obama was saying and using AI.
Yeah.
Especially with Adobe. Adobe now has software to, if you have enough time of someone speaking, you can just make them say anything. You can type it out and it'll be in their voice. And all of this tech is based on, you know, neural nets, which obviously get better exponentially.
Yeah.
So if we think we're somewhere today, in 2 years, we're going to be in a totally new place.
Well, and going back to China, that's like deepfake plus this China social credit system is like the ultimate propaganda machine. Like, look what this person said. Get angry at this person. Wow. And then you're moving around income.
That's scary.
You can mobilize massive groups of people. It really is terrifying. I'm glad to not be living in China, but I'm sure the U.S. is working on something similar.
Everyone loves to like harp on the social credit score and like how bad it is in China.
Right.
I'm going to be honest, like it wasn't that bad.
I mean, that's you as a non-Chinese
citizen. No, 100. Okay, obviously.
There were 30,000 people that were not allowed to travel
in
China last year because of the system.
30,000?
Yeah.
I think it might be more than that.
Is it more than that?
Yeah.
Is it 30 million?
I don't know. It's definitely not 30 million, okay. But like it's
30-something.
It's definitely more than 30,000.
Okay.
But
So what's okay, like Jared, what's right with it? Like what did you feel was a benefit?
I think that it provides very real financial and psychological incentives for behavior. And obviously some of that behavior in the West we view as being wrong. Right? Like morally, we object to you getting better deals on car payments because you love your government more. right? Like that seems very, very off to us.
Right.
But to many people that I talk to in China, right, like they view the People's Party as an extension of their own family, and they feel a lot of love for it. So to them, you know, doing community service, donating to charity, paying your bills on time, you know, not showing up late to meetings, which seems odd, but all of this can in many ways incentivize good behavior that's for the betterment of society. Things get very, very dangerous when it starts incentivizing censorship and unoriginal thought. And, you know, in worst case scenario, like disrespect to minority groups or right. possibly things that like might be illegal. But, you know, so as much as it is a tool for good, obviously it is a tool for oppression as well. But I think that there's many elements of it that like, I don't think it would be bad if, you know, all of us were incentivized to do an extra hour of community service every week.
I agree with that. My problem is that you're leaving the definition of betterment to society up to this one centralized power.
Totally.
So if we had a decentralized social credit scoring system, or maybe we could all vote on what we thought was right and wrong, I'd be more open to that. But when the Chinese government is able to say, oh, you know, it's speaking out against the government killing a bunch of people, for example, obviously they didn't do that, but this is a future,
right.
a hypothetical event. Speaking out against that, we're going to take away your money, or we're going to reduce your social credit score, and suddenly they have immense control over the population.
Absolutely. Yes, the potential for bad is
far outweighs the good.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure. Yes, I don't know if we're at a place where we can say that it far outweighs the good.
Not yet.
Not yet, right? There's always the possibility that is the case.
But also you need to trust that the government or whoever's in charge is good.
Yeah.
Because they can use that for bad, which is one of the negatives, the big pullbacks of that whole structure.
Yeah, yeah. And once again, like, I am not advocating for a central government that decides, like, what morally is good and bad and financially rewards people based on that. All I'm saying is that there are some very positive consequences of it, and I don't know enough, like, in the U.S., we have a democratic system that's only a few hundred years old, right? Like, many societal government... many ways of governing society have like rapidly grown, been incredible, and then fallen, crashed down to earth. And who knows like what works long term and what is right. And I don't think I currently know enough to be able to say that their approach is like actually like terrible. We're going to be bad for their people.
My overall thought in regards to that is that any centralized approach will ultimately fail. It's like Satoshi's law that eventually any centralized system will be corrupted.
Yeah,
So that's my view. I think. Even with governments as a whole, I see that going to a very very decentralized, or at least distributed.
With regards to kind of a voting type play, where because if you look at some countries, especially in the Middle East, where voting, even though people vote, like it's not democratic.
It means
it's
not right.
Like yeah. it means yeah. nothing. A vote is rigged.
Yeah.
And I think with blockchain, that now has the ability for them to change.
Oh yeah.
If they accept and adopt it.
See, blockchain voting is terrifying to me, though.
Really? Why?
Yeah. Blockchain voting scares the shit out of me, just because it is so easy. Unless you have like a truly sound non-sovereign identity system, it is so easy to, and even if you have that, like vote buying, dark DAOs, the ability to like create cartels, most people don't vote in the US right now, which means that like our vote literally is like not worth our time, okay? So would people not sell it? I don't know.
I mean, but that happens now. There are all kinds of documentation of people busing people into different voting places.
But the degrees, or when you look in states where people go door to door and have people fill out absentee ballots. Yes, but the degree to which you can do that and the efficiencies will only go through the roof with blockchain voting.
My thought is that even in the U.S. where we believe that we're like free people, we don't know if our votes count. Like when I go and slip that little piece of plastic into the electronic voting machine, it could just be a piece of plastic with no chip in it that actually doesn't do anything. And I hit a button on a screen and it says thank you, and they just calculate the votes on their own, on their back end.
Yeah.
We don't know. So providing that added layer of transparency, even though it could potentially lead to more vote buying, I think would be beneficial to everybody.
Right, so taking the trust out of the element that you're vote.
Because right now you go to vote, I think a big reason why people have so much voter apathy in the US is that they don't know if their vote counts. Like you go and you submit it and it's like, okay, great, I hope that they count it properly.
And then you find that someone won by like 100,000, you're like, well, that was pointless.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, let's switch it up a little bit. Let's talk about tokenization.
Okay.
Tokenization is something that I find very fascinating, and we've been doing a lot of work here at SVK Crypto. What do you see being adopted first? Do you think tokenized or traditional assets being the big thing that gets everyone going, or would it be the tokenization of smaller things?
I think tokenization of assets, for the most part, is really stupid.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, and here's why. Okay, so that was way too blanket of a statement to make. There's some assets that are great that I think
a lot of controversial
will make sense. But like any art projects that are like, we're going to tokenize all these pieces of art and then like they'll be secondary markets, but they'll trade. Like, one of the reasons art is so valuable is because of how inefficient the markets are for them.
Well, they're very regulated and controlled, right, by the art houses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like the art houses and the galleries themselves, and so much happens behind the scenes that allow art's values to like prop up and decide who's valuable. And I think that if you try to increase the velocity of ownership of any of these pieces of artwork, the effect will be that the value will just like collapse.
See, I look at it a bit differently. I don't think the goal of tokenizing physical artwork, for example, is increasing the velocity. I think it's establishing a more, I guess, legitimate record of provenance. Because right now, you know, obviously the art auction, there's kind of like this open secret of money laundering within the art world.
Yeah.
There are very few auction houses that really do control everything. But one of the things that gives any piece of art its value is the provenance, that you can prove, oh, the artist gave it to this guy who sold it to this guy. So if you can track that on a blockchain and prove it.
1,000,000%. Yeah. Like, I agree that blockchain is incredible for showing provenance. I disagree with the notion that we're going to take this Picasso, you know, make it 100,000 tokens are now this Picasso, and then we're going to float some of them and add liquidity to art markets, which is pretty much every single art project that I've seen outside of the one that's only tracking provenance that's currently working with Sotheby's, whose name I'm forgetting.
Okay.
But
you should look at Pixios as well.
Pixios is interesting.
Yeah. They're working a lot on that NFT, mostly with digital art, but also physical art as well.
Digital art is not where I made that statement. Like, I think digital art can be super cool, and I think that we're going to see tons of collectibles continue to explode in popularity, and actually having digital scarcity is incredible, and all that is awesome. Representing a physical painting as a bunch of tokens and saying that there's going to be more liquidity in them on secondary markets because I think it's just like really naive.
Oh, I totally agree. Yeah. I think if you're going to tokenize a Picasso, it should be an NFT one of one.
Yes.
Like, you shouldn't try fractional. I mean, maybe you could do fractional ownership in the future, but you certainly shouldn't make a bunch of tokens that all represent the full ownership.
No. Even fractional ownership. If you're trying to have liquidity in fractional ownership of incredibly incredibly inefficient artwork, I just don't see how that makes any sense. Like, you don't want people, as the owner of a piece of artwork, especially like a tier one, crazy expensive, multi-$100 million piece, you don't want there to be market pricing on it. You want to be able to like have it go to auction, and maybe you own 100 works or 10 works by this guy. So you give money to someone to secretly bid it up, and the art world is so incredibly manipulated,
right,
and that the big players want to keep doing things like that. And if someone happens to go raise money and buy a Picasso and tokenize it and put it on, I think we'll see the value go back down to earth really fast.
Don't you think that's a good thing, though, if it's then finding its true market value and it's not being manipulated by this
people? I'm not going to make a stance about what is good for art in terms of like values. Like, I have no idea. I think art is incredibly opaque. And I think like it's anything that causes more art to be made is a good thing. But I think a lot of art is being made all the time, and I don't really know if fractional ownership of artwork is going to like cause more art to be made or more high quality art or whatever. I think that finding market prices for things is good, but I think that in certain markets, a lot of the value comes from inefficiencies. And I think that decreasing the value of art might not be a good thing.
My thought on fractional ownership, even with like fractional ownership of real estate, is that it just opens up those investment vehicles to people who previously would have been barred, whether it's a financial thing or an accreditation thing. Like, if I could go out and put $10 and own part of the Mona Lisa or part of a Picasso, that opens me up to a new investment vehicle that previously only the rich had.
Yeah.
And then now suddenly everybody on the street can open up an app and put $5 into an art, $5 into that new building that I'm seeing being built right there.
So I think it's a little bit different when prices are determined. So I think like if we're saying, hey, buy a portion of this artwork and this is what its price is, that's one thing. But like live trading in secondary markets of art is not really applicable in my mind to live trading of real estate. Because like real estate, you can model it, there's cash flows, there's a bunch of comps. Like, I can create a model for any building, and then, you know, if there's secondary markets for liquidity in its token, that's great. We can properly model that. The way I see it, there's only three ways to model any kind of asset. So there's present value of net cash flows. Then there's comps,
Okay.
And then there is like the value of everything that all the materials that it took to create it. You're going to have a really hard time convincing me that there's any other way to value any asset. If you have one, like, please let me know. But to me, like, art is purely comps, where you look at it and you're like, you know what, like, this artist's other work have sold for these things, and you know, pieces from this time period have sold for this, and the last auction, and things generally have this markup. I think art in its entirety is comps, and I think the more comps a market is, the more damage to its price that secondary markets have the potential to do.
See, I agree with that. I think it would likely hurt the secondary price, but I view that as a good thing, because I think then it's just finding its true value versus the manipulated value. And any time we can find, let the market, sort of let the free market work versus like these few people. Actually, we should ask and be transparent. Is Sotheby's paying you to say these things?
Sotheby's is paying me nothing.
I'm just kidding, yeah.
I will say, like, a lot of good friends of mine.
Okay,
so
what do we think? Do we think that traditional assets are going to be tokenized first, or do we think that maybe shoes, comic books, items, they're going to be tokenized? Like, what do we see being adopted first? What do you think is going to have the most go?
I honestly think digital items. I mean, if you look at any kind of digital item, like you're talking about Brock's Internet Gaming Entertainment, where he worked with Brendan Bloomer and some other people, they were effectively one of the first people to trade digital currency, trading World of Warcraft gold and all these other things.
Right.
I probably bought gold from them back in the day. But I think yeah, absolutely. you look at places like Opskins, yeah, and all these others that have real value assigned to digital goods.
Yep.
I think more of that's going to happen, where if you're launching a game, you're going to tokenize it, because all of the gamers are going to want to play a game where they own the assets and may be able to get some value out of those assets.
What do you think, Jared?
I agree with that. I think that digital assets is where a lot of the initial growth will come. I think if you want to try and speculate where the real world tokenization will come from, I think we're likely to see large scale tokenization of real estate. That in terms of, I think you can look at adoption in one of two ways. One is like the total value of all the assets that are being tokenized, and then like the total community interaction, like how many different people are interacting with these tokenized assets. I think we're going to see way more value in the real world come from real estate than shoes, theoretically. And I think we'll probably see more people interacting with that than shoes as well.
Yeah, real estate excites me, especially whether it's fractional ownership or not. But you can imagine if you had all of the real estate in New York, say, tokenized, you could have baskets where you could short the East Side and long the West Side, or short Billionaires Road and long somewhere else.
Yeah.
It opens up the market 100%. To all these new sort of directives that you didn't have before.
Tokenized, I don't think tokenized real estate is stupid. I like tokenized real estate.
We don't have any real estate buddies that are...
Oh, no, I have plenty of real estate buddies, but they're tokenizing.
Okay. Well, that will likely help those people as well. I mean, there are so many benefits to that. So,
traditional equities? What about tokenizing the financial markets? Do you feel that's something that will take place? I know a lot of people have spoken about it, but it's going to take a lot of time for that to come through.
I think not if, but when, right?
Yeah.
So it's a better way to track assets. It's a better way to have like multi-party settlement. There's one company in the world right now that tracks like and physically custodies all equities in the US market. Yeah, literally one company. I'm forgetting the name, but there's one company, and I encourage you to look it up and be better at remembering things than me. But so basically, like what we trade and what we interact with are derivatives of those shares that are custodied by this one company, and that one company like makes like millions, hundreds of millions a year, I think. Not hundreds. I think they make like tens of millions a year.
They're worth
hundreds of millions.
They're trading trillions of dollars in assets.
Yeah, but they have like a weird monopoly, and they take a very, very small percentage to be allowed to continue to operate that monopoly.
Right.
They're killing it. But essentially, like everything that we trade in U.S. equities markets are all technically derivatives. They're one-to-one derivatives, but derivatives nonetheless, in the same way that like a stablecoin is a derivative of a U.S. dollar. So I think that those assets will be represented on-chain. The question is, will it be a public chain? Will it be a private federated chain? Will it be a government chain? I don't know, but distributed ledger technology is clearly superior than the current system.
I totally agree. Yeah, I mean, I think even if you look at something like JPM Coin, and everybody's like upset about it, I mean, they're using blockchain technology for the major efficiency gains on the back end of settlement and all these different things. So I think that's a good thing. It brings more people into crypto. They understand the tech.
I love JPM Coin.
Link to a public blockchain.
I'm a huge fan.
Okay.
And here's why, all right? A lot of people think, why would we generate a stablecoin on a Quorum instance?
Right.
This seems stupid. And sure, maybe technically it's way inferior to like any other thing that they could have done. But at the end of the day, we're going to be able to use multi-collateral DAI, multi-collateral contracts in MakerDAO to generate DAI, and nothing excites me more than being able to put a dollar in JP Morgan Chase and being able to turn that dollar one-to-one into DAI with no interest. I don't see a world where we don't have specialized contracts for stablecoins that have like banking relationships in the US, because like the amount of risk on that is so incredibly low. So who knows, like maybe JP Morgan will say any stablecoins of ours that pass through a MakerDAO contract are now invalidated and just shit on everyone's parade.
Right.
Maybe they do that. I don't know. And a part of me hopes that like there's enough fanboys over there that are sitting being like, wow, MakerDAO is really cool. Like maybe let's not do this. That will let it happen. Huh. So I got really excited from that perspective. And people love to like trash on the big banks and say that they don't get it. But like the fact that they're doing this at all means that they have some people that are just fans.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you look at, I mean, JP Morgan's had a blockchain team for coming on
5 years. Their blockchain team's based here. I know some of the guys.
Really?
Yeah. They invented Quorum. Like it was invented inside. So like I'm actually pretty excited about it. And yes, it's a super limited thing. But at the end of the day, like my mom texts me being like, "Is this mean Bitcoin's gonna go up?"
Yeah.
And I'm like,
"This text as well."
Yeah, yeah.
Or is this mean Bitcoin's gonna die? I read an article that says the new Bitcoin. Like, no, it's a stable coin. Yeah, it's intended not to go up.
It gives more attention, and I think that eventually it'll migrate over to either ERC20 or EOS or many other chains. And I think that having these centralized points being able to interact with decentralized ecosystems will only be good for decentralized ecosystems.
Agreed. So let's talk about funding, right? Because we've seen in the short space of time in the crypto space, a lot of different changes take place. We saw the ICO market come through, which was probably one of the most exciting times to be involved in the space. Everyone had the ability to invest, to participate, to be part of something very exciting. And it was probably the first time in history that we've seen the retail person have, or the retail investor have an advantage over the institutional investor, right? They were the first people in. And
the term advantage is relative, right?
Yeah. Right. It depends when you got out.
Yeah, exactly.
But now we're looking at the STO market. And do you feel that the STO market is something that will sustain the funding model? Or do you think something else will take its place? I'm trying to work out what your views are to how you see funding taking place. Or do you feel that in the crypto space and blockchain space, it'll be kind of traditional VCs that take back charge? What's your views on this?
So when I was at, I founded ICO Alert and ran that from 2017 to the beginning of 2018 and then exited there. And what we saw was even after that, when sort of the whole ICO market collapsed, more and more people were moving to just private VC funding for early stage. And that I think is what's gonna happen. There were a lot of people, myself included, even like giving presentations like, ICOs are gonna kill VCs, this is the new venture cap, like here it is, go. Yeah. And then obviously that was sort of short-lived. So I think it will likely be more of the same systems that exist today, VCs in early stage, you do a Series A, you continue.
It's kind of a shame that wouldn't be challenged again.
Well, I mean, I don't think that it won't be challenged again. I just think that right now the current market state isn't one where people are like jumping at the or chomping at the bit to run and put money in an ICO.
I think like the early stage investing is incredibly difficult.
Right.
And the groups that are really good at it are really good at it for a reason, and they add a lot of value to these teams.
Right.
So if I'm trying to raise money, the pros of doing an ICO would be maybe there's an implicit community of early users that are all, invested in its success. So the question is, like, are they going to be more valuable and more bought in than, a group that's been able to scale multi-billion dollar companies if you're raising from a top-tier VC?
Well, and that's a good point, too, because I think it depends on the model and what you're trying to get funded. If you're trying to build an ecosystem like EOS that requires a wide distribution, you need to do a token sale over a certain period of time.
Yeah.
But if you're, doing something that doesn't require your tokens to be widely distributed, whatever it is, you can just go to a VC and say, hey, this is what we're going to do.
And I think an interesting way to look at it is how will the distribution of tokens change? And I think we're going to see more and more tokens being distributed, not from these crowd sales, but actually from usage of platforms. For instance, like the casino that I'm here working with, like we plan to have a direct tie into the amount of wagers that you make. In terms of tokens are similar to how EOS Bet functions.
Right.
So in ways like the users of a community will be able to get some kind of ownership stake in it. So I think that you'll see this with a bunch of services where people are trying to bootstrap a bit of a community, and then the people that are early participants actually become a part owner instead of having to pay just from using. So I think we'll see more and more of that, definitely from a utility token standpoint. But I think, if securities laws change in the US, Airbnb submitted that request to have them change so that they could reward some of their best hosts with little bits of equity.
Uber did the same.
Yeah. So I think we'll start seeing a lot of that happen, and hopefully that distribution takes place on a public ledger.
Yeah.
Do you think STOs are a viable model for funding, or do you think VCs are better suited based on everything you've just said?
I don't get how an STO isn't the same as raising money from a VC. Like, correct me if I'm wrong, but to me, an STO is institutional investors investing in securities. Like, raising money from VCs is institutional investors investing in securities. So the question is, like, are you getting a bunch of smaller checks or a bunch of bigger checks? But the people writing the checks are largely a similar demographic.
Right.
Like, this isn't, you know, your friend who, you know, works part-time at Subway being like, oh my God, there's this incredible opportunity. I'm going to put a little bit of money in and hopefully, like, I get some returns. No, like, these are institutional investors. So to me, like, an STO is like a clever way of trying to raise a little bit more money by playing on a little bit of the hype. Hmm. But I've never seen an STO and thought to myself, like, this is any different than someone just raising a traditional equity round through selling securities, equity or bonds or whatever you're selling.
Especially since it requires you to be an accredited investor.
Yeah, like,
right.
Yeah.
The entry level is no lower.
I've been super confused by all these like STO platforms that pop up, just trying to like figure out what's their moat, what's their business model, because largely, you know, it'll become commoditized in terms of just generating tokens. And then a lot of them I see saying, oh, well, we're going to also have the exchange and we'll take fees from the exchange. But it's, if you're, okay, the point of a security token would be to have like a bearer instrument that has settlement baked into it so that you can transfer it around and, you know, you understand provenance and you can move it around. So trying to ring fence a security token to a specific exchange completely defeats the purpose to begin with. So any of these groups that try doing that, I don't understand why any company would do a security token offering with them. So generally, I think that like there'll have to be interoperability between exchanges. You'll see a few players come out on top. And I just don't understand how it's any different than traditional equities.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, let's talk about something different. I know, Jared, you've done a lot of models, and Rob, I'm sure you're pretty up to speed on that as well. But with the financial market, right, and equities, we haven't really seen the correlation between that and token prices and what's going on in our space, right? They've been pretty uncorrelated thus far. What do you feel is going to happen when the equity market pulls back, when we hit maybe another recession, which we're overdue? Do you feel that maybe a lot of that capital will come into Bitcoin and crypto, or do you not see that happening? It'd be interesting to see what happens there.
I think it's possible. I think one of the best side effects of this recent bull market that we've had, especially the slowdown, the giant crash from, you know, 20,000 all the way to where we are now, one of the biggest benefits of that is that it's sort of shown that crypto is an uncorrelated asset, at least to traditional things like equities. So in the event that the equity market goes the other way and starts going down and we end this, if we already haven't, some could argue, this like 10 plus year long bull market, I could see a lot of that money moving there. And I think Anthony Pompliano's done a good job of this. Some other people have done a good job of getting these giant, these massive endowments and these institutions off zero. So take 50 basis points, pop it in, you know, Bitcoin or whatever, and just let it ride. And that might increase to, you know, 500 basis points over time.
Right.
I always looked at Bitcoin as a hedge against chaos, right? Like,
I like that.
Yeah, like if you think that people in charge maybe don't know what they're doing, and that society has a tendency to break down over time, that Bitcoin, in existence without rulers, is a decent hedge against that. So I think that if markets pull back, we'll see a little bit of money go in. I also think we'll see a bunch of money come out. And I think I think that if the current economic situation globally takes a turn similar to 08, it will be bad for everybody in the short term. But I think coming out of that, people will realize, oh my God, this is fucked. I don't want to trust another centralized currency. So I think in the aftermath of that wreckage, a lot more money will flow into digital assets that have some kind of like real scarcity or some real understand rules about them, and not just like modern monetary theory. It doesn't matter if we can't pay back our debt because we'll always print more money. Like, I think that's fucking crazy. QE is one thing, but like literally saying like debt doesn't matter because we have the ability to print our way out of it is insane. And that has been like, did Alan Greenspan say something like that recently?
Probably.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. The former chairman. Yeah.
That's like when Jamie Dimon was like, you know, recessions are good for JP Morgan. And it was like, oh, come on, Jamie. Like, so tone deaf. I guess that's what happens when you're a banker.
Oh my gosh. So what do you see the future looking like in your own words? What does it look like? What do we think?
Future?
The future.
In what context?
Well, you've talked about driverless cars, right? Do you feel there'll be a future where your car picks you up
Okay.
You're in the car. You go to the petrol station. It pays with a token for the petrol. There's no
I could give you my ideal version of it.
Right. Like, give me a view. Give me an outlook.
Yeah. So basically, like, I think we'll see a few trends globally continue to take shape. One, like, automation will be absolutely huge. I think we'll see a continued growing of conflict between the China and the U.S. Or big China, that's terrible. China and the U.S. I think that, you know, we're seeing a lot of stuff via the One Belt, One Road initiative.
Right.
That I wouldn't say is scary to me, but definitely showing global geopolitical macro shifts. When you look at, like, the importance of the South China Sea, right, part of our occupation in the Philippines, and then there were the fake islands, a lot of that is because that was China's main oil route, where if you wanted to, like, throw a blockade and stop China from getting oil, the South China Sea was the way to do it. And that's why there was so much contention. What you're seeing now is in Pakistan, they had a deep sea port that was fully paid for by China via loans, and then high-speed railways through Pakistan to China that they also paid for via loans, that then Pakistan defaulted on. So then they gave them a 100-year lease on the land and the things on top of it. So now you can actually take oil up through the deep sea port in Pakistan, high-speed railways right into China, and all of a sudden you're good. So you're seeing a lot more of these initiatives where global power, I'm not saying it's shifting completely, but definitely shifting a little bit. So where does that come into play in terms of the developing world? Well, after World War II, via the Marshall Plan, the U.S. was able to really solidify itself as the global power by not only providing, you know, economic assistance, but also technological assistance in a lot of these places rebuilding. If you look in the developing world, specifically in Africa and Nigeria, there's a massive tech scene that's exploding. Mm. And across all of Africa, you're seeing a lot of public investments being made by the Chinese government. Well, I think part of that will also be technological sharing. So I think you'll see an increasingly globalized world. The question is, you know, who is making those connections and how does it play out? Payments are super inefficient right now in the U.S. and in England as well, right? People still use credit cards for things. We don't have mobile. In China, because they never actually built up those credit card payment rails, it was really easy for Alipay and WeChat Pay to become the de facto, you know, payment rails in banking. So I think we'll see a lot more of that happening in the developed world, where these things that we kind of just assume to be true in terms of, like, hurdles to innovation will erode.
So surely that would take power away from the US and China to developing countries and kind of equal out the playing field.
Maybe. I mean, definitely. I think the question is, like, who, these new systems, whose infrastructure will they be built on?
Right.
Will they be built on open protocols? Will they be built based on US things? Will they be, you know, built under a special segued version of the internet that China controls? We're seeing other countries wanting to opt in to the Chinese firewall. I'm forgetting the exact country that they're about to license some of their stuff to, but, like, yeah, other places want in, specifically, like, the more despotic or authoritarian leaders.
Hmm.
So I think that we're going to see a world that technology gets more and more important, and the people supplying that technology gets more and more important, and the points of access can either be increasingly open or increasingly closed. And I don't know which way it's going to go. I think in the U.S. they'll get increasingly open. But I think in other parts of the world, it might dwarf us. So
yeah, I'll take a slightly different approach without the government. I think my ideal view of the world, you know, we mentioned those two scenarios, either, you know, super intelligent AI and automation are incredibly beneficial for humanity, and that's what I hope happens, or they're incredibly negative. I see a world where, you know, there are a lot of things that are automated today that used to not be automated. Like, you have a washing machine, a dishwasher, all these things. I think more and more of our life will be automated in a way that hopefully helps out everybody, to the point where, you know, if your job gets automated away, maybe you can actually survive on a UBI or some other kind of system. You're living in the metaverse, whatever it is, and sort of pursue your own passion. And I think the more that we can shift humanity from, you know, grinding away at these 9-to-5 jobs that people hate and, you know, wishing for the weekend and living your life 2 out of 7 days of the week, the more we can shift it from that to people following their individual passions, whether that's art or, you know, starting a business or just being creative in some way, the better off we will all be as a society. So that's my hope, is that we take advantage of automation and potentially AI as well to allow people to basically give people more freedom. I'm a big proponent of freedom. The more freedom people have, I think the better off we all are. So that's my ideal hope for the future, kind of a high level.
I'd agree with that. I'd hope that all these things give us more freedom.
That's the timeline I'm clicking into, you know?
Yeah, no, that's good. I saw a factory that a company called JD.com, which is like an e-commerce giant in China, runs. And they were shipping a few 100,000 packages a day in a fulfillment center. And they had 4 employees. They just fixed, prepared all the robots.
Wow.
4 employees?
4 employees, several hundred thousand dollars. Wow. So it was, yeah, so you see things like that and you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
This is coming.
Oh, definitely.
But I am a little scared, not that automation will have all these issues in terms of displacement. I'm scared that we won't even be able to get to that point because of regulatory barriers. I think when you look at like really powerful unions in the US, the Teamster Union is one of the most powerful unions. You said 5 million people.
Yeah.
I personally, if I was in that position, would do everything in my power to stop automated trucks being legal without me being involved. When you look at the standardization of railroad tracks in the US, so different railroads used to have different distances between their wheels. And this was really inefficient because they would link up to each other and they would have to stop. And there were a bunch of workers that would physically go and change the distance of the wheels to meet the new track and roll it onto the new track. And this employed thousands of people across the US. The government was like, what the fuck are we doing? This is really inefficient. Let's standardize a distance. Everyone needs to change over their tracks to make it the standard distance. But this meant thousands of people were going to be out of jobs. So all the people whose jobs this were rioted, literally burned tracks, burned train cars, because they didn't want to be out of jobs. And this was literally just something that would like make society clearly better.
Yeah.
It was just getting rid of a clear inefficiency. And I think that visceral reaction of like, let's burn it down, like it is against us. I think that is still very present with us. And I don't think, you know, we're going to see truckers burning their trucks.
Well, I think we did with Uber. I mean, Uber with especially the France riots were insane. Oh, with people blockading roads and setting things on fire. Yep. But ultimately, Uber, I think, sort of won that battle and is now out on top. So I think a lot of it is, you know, people aren't asking for permission. They're sort of asking for forgiveness later. And I think it'll likely be the same thing with even self-driving cars. Like, there are these weird legal loopholes where you can have a self-driving car that's fully autonomous as long as the driver is legally responsible.
Totally. And certain pop-ups. And I hope that continues to happen. But honestly, like, one of my biggest fears is that, you know, we have fully autonomous self-driving cars, but the law requires you to have someone in them at all times, being paid the same wages. And
well, and that's how it is now. You can't just send a car off and let
but
it go.
I think that for the world, like, that's a net positive for the world. Like, if you have a whole fleet of trucks and cars that are fully autonomous, you can optimize for speed, you can optimize for fuel efficiency, energy conservation. All of a sudden, like, the net output in terms of environmental impact of all the cars on the road goes dramatically down. All these things are very good things. But humans can kind of stand in the way of them.
Yeah.
And that's one of my biggest fears is that people, and this sounds incredibly arrogant or elitist in many ways because like it's not my livelihood that's at stake. So I am clearly biased. But I hope that, you know, society can come to a place where it's no longer people's complete livelihoods that are at stake and we can kind of get out of the way of progress.
Yeah.
And because I think true automation will be one of those things that will actually help us offset climate change.
Well, I don't think I think if we always prioritize the human in their job, we'd still be riding horses and buggies because the buggy makers and the people stabling your horse and all these different things wouldn't have jobs. And I think it's a lot of the same now. Like if you just, for only the sake of keeping a human in the car to pay them, if you make that a regulation, I think that's a very bad thing for, you know, society's whole. And I know Learn to Code is kind of a meme now. Maybe we'll get this podcast taken out for saying Learn to Code.
Are you Yang Gang?
I was Yang Gang until I realized that the UBI was coming from a 10% tax hike across all business services. I was like, I don't know that I'm part of Yang Gang anymore.
Yeah.
But, you know, socialists love to tax. But that's a whole nother topic. But yeah, so that's, I think that's a good we'll leave it at that.
Yeah. All right, so guys, how can people contact you? What's the best place to check out your work or keep up to date with what you guys are doing?
If you're in Telegram, just search Cypherglass and hop in and say hello.
Yeah, so you can tweet at me or just message me on Twitter at Jared Madfis. Or you can look at blockswan.io. Blockswan, that's the name of my...
I like it.
Custody insurance thing. But you really won't find anything about me or anything that I do, so... Yeah,
Twitter's the best way.
Yeah, I guess I don't even really use Twitter, but I'm just thinking in terms of contact. I'm like pretty incognito as a person.
Yeah, and if you're out there and you want to learn more about EOS, if you go to YouTube as well and either search everything EOS or Cypherglass, Cypher Glass, you'll see tons of educational videos about EOS, tons of in-depth podcasts, sort of like this one. So check it out.
Awesome. Well, that's a wrap, guys. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. Let's get some more black teas for you Americans.
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's go.
Now, if you enjoyed today's podcast as much as we did making it, make sure to subscribe to the SVK Crypto 15 Minutes of Crypto Fame podcast. Hit us up on Twitter at SVK_crypto. Follow us on Telegram, SVK_crowd. And if you have any questions or queries, feel free to get in touch with myself, which is cstory. That's the best email to reach me on, cstory@svkcrypto.com. Thank you so much for your time and attention. That's a wrap.